Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. As I mentioned the previous two episodes, since I started this podcast, I've received hundreds of emails asking about the events on the day of the assassination and afterwards that lead me to believe that there was a conspiracy to kill President John F. Kennedy. People want to know the absolutes I stand by regarding the Kennedy assassination, those key points that, in my view, prove a conspiracy, or at least suggest that things were not as they seemed or as we were told they were. Today, we continue our miniseries that we're calling The JFK Assassination: Hills to Die On. A hill to die on refers to a cause, belief, or position someone is so strongly committed to that they are willing to fight for it to the very end, even if it means facing significant consequences or defeat. Essentially, it's an issue someone considers so important they are prepared to stand their ground no matter what. Over the next several episodes, I'll be covering what I consider the crucial points, the hills to die on when it comes to the JFK assassination. Like we talked about last week, one of the biggest hills that I choose to die on in this case is the fact that we know with absolute certainty that there was someone impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald for weeks or possibly months leading up to the assassination. Also, last week I admitted that for years I didn't believe the two Oswald theory, despite my fellow researchers trying to prove me otherwise. It wasn't until the late 90s when I took a break from other research in this case and clearly focused on the double Oswalds in and around Dallas leading up to the assassination. I met with dozens of witnesses, a few that had never been spoken to before, dug through testimonies, spoke with other researchers, and after many months of focusing on the two Oswald theory, I came away more convinced about this happening than almost any other thing in this case. There is not a single doubt in my mind that someone was impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald and setting up a narrative for him for some time before the assassination. I found during my research that many of the sightings of a second Oswald was seen by multiple witnesses. This was not just some random person who resembled Oswald. In most instances, witnesses reported that the man they identified as Lee Harvey Oswald provided specific details about Oswald's life, such as his family and his past, that made it clear he wanted people to believe he was Oswald, even if he wasn't the real one. The question I have is, why was someone doing this, and who was doing this? Think about it for a minute. These impersonations were done for a reason. These took a lot of time, effort, and money. This was not someone out doing it for fun. And why would you impersonate Lee Harvey Oswald anyway? He was just a nobody, a lone nut. Isn't that right, Warren Commission?
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
The Oswald imposter issue becomes even more troubling in light of the fact that questions about Oswald's identity surfaced well before the assassination. In June 1960, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover asked the State Department for any current information it might receive on Oswald, quote, since there is a possibility that an imposter is using Oswald's birth certificate, end quote. In March 1961, the Passport Office informed the State Department, quote, it has been stated that there is an imposter using Oswald's identification data and that no doubt the Soviets would love to get a hold of his valid passport, end quote. Keep in mind, the FBI has told the American public for years. They only knew about Oswald a few short months before the assassination. But we have a June 1960 document from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover that proves otherwise. This incident and all the others we're speaking about today are public record. You can look them up yourself. There are dozens of potential second Oswald sightings in the record, and we're just covering a few of them on this podcast. Last week, we focused on the months leading up to the assassination, where a second Oswald was sighted in and around Dallas. This person that wanted people to think he was Oswald was seen at the gun range several times, a furniture store, a car dealership, applying for a job at a couple of radio stations around the Dallas area. He also spoke with Laura Cottrell at the Texas Employment Commission, trying to convince her that he was Lee Harvey Oswald, when she knew it wasn't the real Lee Oswald, because she had spoken to him on several occasions. This person also applied for a job at the Hill Machinery Company and put down the name Oswald on his application, and his Marine service was also listed on the form. These are just a few places that the person was seen impersonating Lee Harvey Oswald, when we know for a fact that the real Lee Harvey Oswald was present at other places during these times. Go back and listen to last week's episode to hear all about these sightings in more detail. In this week's episode, we're going to focus on incredible sightings of this man in the week of the assassination. Hang on tight here, because it's about to get good. About a week before the assassination, a man by the name of John Thomas was on a city bus in downtown Dallas. He was sitting by a man he would later know as Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin of President Kennedy. Thomas said the man told him his name was Lee, and he and Lee spoke for several minutes. Lee told Mr. Thomas about his children, one being only a month old, and his wife that was from Russia. He said Lee seemed like a nice young fellow. Lee would then get off the bus. Thomas then said only a couple blocks later, the bus would stop again, and a man would get on the bus that looked like the identical twin of the guy that he was sitting with and talking to, which he knew was Lee. Mr. Thomas said he was across the aisle from this man and was astounded how much he looked like the man he knew was Lee that had just gotten off the bus a few blocks back. He would then approach this man and say, quote, "Hey there, fellow, you don't happen to have a twin brother, do you?" End quote. Mr. Thomas said the man just looked up at him and mumbled something under his breath, and then started staring straight ahead. Mr. Thomas then said, quote, "I'm serious. There was a man on the bus just a few blocks back that looks identical to you," end quote. The man continued to ignore Mr. Thomas, so Thomas would go back to his seat and sit down. Mr. Thomas would say the two men were alike in every way, same build, complexion, hairstyle, etc. He said the only thing different about them was their clothing. He said that after a few blocks, as the bus was coming to a stop, the man would get up, give Mr. Thomas a very dirty look, and get off the bus. Mr. Thomas would go home later and tell his wife about what happened on the bus. About a week later, Mr. Thomas would see Lee Harvey Oswald on the television, accused of killing President Kennedy, and he was amazed. He told his wife, "That's the guy I was telling you about on the bus, or at least one of them." Mr. Thomas would then tell me, quote, "I'm not sure which one I saw that day was the one on the TV that night. It could have been either one of them. The entire incident has haunted me for years. I don't know who I was speaking with that day on the bus. Was the real Lee Harvey Oswald the nice fellow that spoke with me, or was he the other fellow who ignored me and shot me a dirty look as he got off the bus? I'll never know," end quote. The time is Wednesday, November 20th at 10 a.m. Mary Dowling was a waitress at the Dobbs House Restaurant located at 1221 North Beckley, only about a block from Lee Harvey Oswald's rooming house at 1026 North Beckley. She spoke with the FBI and gave testimony on December 6, 1963, about seeing Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dobbs House Restaurant on Wednesday morning, November 20th, around 10 a.m. She said that Oswald was apparently in an ugly mood at that time, and she said he cursed at her regarding his order. She said she told him that if his order was not right, that the Dobbs House would make it right. She said that shortly thereafter, Oswald again used cuss words in addressing her, because she did not give him more coffee as soon as he thought she should have. She recalled that Officer J.D. Tippett was in the Dobbs House restaurant at the same time, apparently as a customer, and that when Tippett heard Oswald making his outburst toward her, Tippett shot a glance at Oswald. She said Oswald was already getting ready to leave and nothing was said between Tippett and Oswald. She stated that there was no indication that Tippett and Oswald ever knew each other. She said that Tippett usually came in the restaurant each morning around 10 a.m. or shortly thereafter to drink coffee. One problem with this sighting of Lee Harvey Oswald at the Dobbs House restaurant on Wednesday, November 20th, 1963, is that at that time he was supposedly at the restaurant, he was really at work at the Texas School Book Depository, verified by his co-workers and his time card. So who was this at the Dobbs House restaurant on the morning of November 20th making a scene? Hold on, it gets better. The assassination of President Kennedy continued to suck innocent people into its whirlwind. One was a man who was kind enough to pick up a hitchhiker in Dallas. He was then caught up in darkness for the rest of his life. It is one of the saddest stories to come out of the assassination other than JFK being killed. Ralph Leon Yates was a refrigeration mechanic for the Texas Butcher Supply Company in Dallas, making his rounds to meat outlets on Wednesday, November 20, 1963. At 10:30 a.m., Ralph Yates was driving on R.L. Thornton Expressway. He noticed a man hitchhiking in Oak Cliff near the Beckley Avenue entrance to the expressway. Yates stopped to pick up the man. Keep in mind that the man that is passing himself off as Lee Harvey Oswald has just left the Dobbs House restaurant and is walking down Beckley Avenue. Yates said after seeing photographs and television pictures of Lee Harvey Oswald, he is of the opinion that this man was identical with Oswald. Yates said when the man walked up to get into the pickup truck, he was carrying a package wrapped in brown wrapping paper about 4 feet to 4.5 feet long. He said he told the man he could put the package in the back of the truck, but the man said that the package contained curtain rods and he would carry it with him in the cab of the truck. Yates stated as they drove along, the man asked him if he knew a certain party whose name Yates could not recall. Yates said the man then asked him if he had ever been to the Carousel Club in Dallas, and Yates replied that he had serviced refrigerators in the past at a number of clubs and that he possibly had been to that one, but he did not recall for sure. Yates mentioned to the man that people were getting excited about the president's upcoming visit. He had broached a subject the man was eager to talk about. The man had a remarkable sense, as seen later, of what would become the government's case against Lee Harvey Oswald. The man also looked so much like Oswald that he was in fact his double. Yates then told the man that he personally felt like the president should not come to Dallas in view of the Adlai Stevenson incident, which had occurred previously. Yates said that the man asked him something that he couldn't believe. Yates stated that the man then asked him if he thought a person could assassinate the president. Yates replied that he guessed such a thing could be possible. The man then asked Yates if it could be done from the top of a building or out of a window high up. And Yates said he guessed it would be possible if one had a good rifle with a scope and was a good shot. Yates advised about this time that the man pulled out a picture which showed a man with a rifle, and he asked Yates if he thought the president could be killed with a gun like the one in the picture. Yates said he was driving and did not look at the picture, but indicated to the man that he guessed so. Yates said that the man then asked if he knew the president's route for the parade in Dallas, and Yates replied that he did not know the route, but it had been in the papers. He said that the man then said that he had misunderstood him, and that he actually had asked Yates if he thought that the president would change his route. Yates replied that he doubted it unless there would be safety concerns. Yates said he felt like the conversation was staged or rehearsed in some way. The hitchhiker then asked to be led off along Houston Street. Yates dropped him off at Elm and Houston, the stoplight by the Texas School Book Depository. He last saw the man carrying his package of curtain rods across Elm Street, perhaps into the Texas School Book Depository building. When Ralph Yates returned to his workplace at the Texas Butcher Supply Company later that day, keep in mind this is 2 days before the assassination, he told his co-worker Dempsey Jones about this strange conversation with the man he picked up in Oak Cliff and dropped off at Elm and Houston, who was carrying the package. Dempsey Jones thereby became a supporting witness to Yates' account. He confirmed in an FBI interview that it was before President Kennedy was assassinated that Yates described picking up the hitchhiker. Yates would also tell his wife Dorothy the story when he got home from work later that same day. A few days later, after Yates saw the pictures in the media of Lee Harvey Oswald, he said the man he gave the ride to was, quote, identical with Oswald, end quote. Oddly enough, at the time that Yates had dropped off the hitchhiker, Oswald had already clocked in for work at the depository and had been working most of the morning. We know this from his time cards when he clocked in and from the testimony of some of his co-workers. Therefore, it wasn't possible that Yates could have picked up the real Lee Harvey Oswald. It is possible, however, that Yates could have picked up a lookalike. The FBI was not happy with the statement Ralph Leon Yates volunteered to them on November 26, 1963, just 4 days after the president's assassination. He repeated at the FBI's request on December 10th and repeated yet again at their further request on January 3rd and 4th during an FBI polygraph examination. Although Yates' statement seemed to be thorough incrimination of the now-dead Oswald, once again, as in the other Oswald appearances, it proved too much for the government's case, even placing that case in jeopardy. As the FBI would make clear, the witness wasn't wanted. They kept recalling him in order to discredit his story. What was so unacceptable about Ralph Yates' testimony? In terms of the hitchhiker's looks, itinerary, and comments, he was either Lee Harvey Oswald or a well-informed double. The Beckley Avenue entrance to the Thornton Expressway was on the same street as Oswald's rooming house, located at 1026 North Beckley. The man looking like Oswald had hitched a ride from the vicinity of Oswald's rooming house to the location of Oswald's workplace, the Texas School Book Depository. The man's comments were, like Oswald's behavior, in the series of self-incriminating incidents we have already seen, an obvious attempt to draw attention to himself as a potential presidential assassin. Most significant in this instance was the package in brown wrapping paper that the man insisted on keeping with him in the cab of the truck, which he said contained, quote, curtain rods. The package of curtain rods carried by Yates' hitchhiker corresponds to Oswald's notorious cover story in the Warren Report for sneaking his rifle into the book depository. As the Warren Report describes this incident, it was on Thursday, November 21st, that Lee Harvey Oswald asked his co-worker, Buell Wesley Frazier, if he could ride home with him that afternoon. Frazier lived in Irving, half a block from Ruth Payne's house, where Oswald's wife Marina and their two daughters were staying. Frazier then asked Oswald why he wanted to ride with him on Thursday rather than Friday, when Lee normally went to the Payne household to stay with his family over the weekend. Lee's answer reportedly was, quote, I'm going home to get some curtain rods to put in my apartment, end quote. According to Frazier and his sister Lenny Mae Randall, the next morning Oswald brought a brown paper package about 2 feet long with him when he rode in Frazier's car back to the book depository. Frazier told the Warren Commission that when he asked Oswald what was in the package, he replied, quote, curtain rods. Despite the fact that the package Frazier and Randall claimed they said they saw was too small to even hold a rifle that was broken down, and although no one else saw Oswald with any package at all that morning, the Warren Commission concluded that Oswald must have used such a ruse to smuggle his rifle from Ruth Payne's garage into the depository building. In the Warren Report, the curtain rod story is the crucial lie that supposedly enabled Oswald to carry secretly the weapon that he then used to murder the president. What then are we to make of Ralph Yates' Oswald-like hitchhiker, who prophetically acted out the curtain rod story 2 days before Lee Oswald reportedly reenacted it in his ride with Buell Wesley Frazier to the Texas School Book Depository the morning of November 22nd? Had there been no second curtain rod slash rifle delivery by Oswald to the depository, the first as done by the Oswald Ralph Yates picked up, it could have served the Warren Commission quite well. Oswald could have been portrayed as smuggling the rifle into the depository on Wednesday, then hiding it on the sixth floor of the building until he used it to shoot the president on Friday. In that version of the story, Yates could have been a valuable witness for the government against an already dead, media-convicted assassin. However, just as there was once again a problem of too many Oswalds, with one working his regular hours in the book depository, while the other was hitchhiking with Yates, so too there was a problem of too many curtain rod deliveries to account for one rifle being smuggled into the building. The trail of duplicating curtain rod stories led not to the lone assassin, but to an intelligence operation tripping all over itself, while working overtime to scapegoat Oswald. Ralph Yates was a stubborn witness to what turned out to be unwanted evidence. On his second trip to the Dallas FBI office on December 10, 1963, he repeated and signed his statement about picking up the hitchhiker with the curtain rods. From his first contact with the FBI, Yates, who had pointed out that he was married with 5 children, said, quote, would appreciate not receiving any type of publicity from the fact he was furnishing this information, end quote. About that, he need not have worried. The FBI would make certain his testimony to another Oswald with a second curtain rod story would be buried from public view. On January 2, 1964, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover sent a teletype marked urgent to Dallas Special Agent in Charge J. Gordon Shanklin on Ralph Leon Yates.
Yes, Ralph Leon Yates was so important that the FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover was now involved. Hoover therefore ordered the Dallas FBI office to re-interview Yates with a polygraph test, the instrument more commonly known as a lie detector. On January 4th, in another urgent teletype, Shanklin reported back to Hoover on Yates' polygraph examination that day. It said, quote, "Results of the test were inconclusive, as Yates responded to neither relevant or control type questions," end quote. Because his lie detector test was inconclusive, Yates had still not been discredited. But there was more to come. During his final January 4 trip to the FBI office, Ralph Yates was accompanied by his wife, Dorothy. He had asked her to come with him. In an interview 45 years later, she told me what happened next to her husband. After he completed his inconclusive lie detector test, she said the FBI told him he needed to go immediately to Woodlawn Hospital, the Dallas Hospital for the Mentally Ill. He drove there with Dorothy. He was admitted that evening as a psychiatric patient. From that point on, he spent the remaining 11 years of his life as a patient in and out of mental health hospitals. A crucial transition in the psychic health of Ralph Yates seemed to have occurred at the FBI office on January 4, 1964. Something the FBI said after Ralph Yates' polygraph test puzzled and disturbed Dorothy. She would say, quote, "They told me that he was telling the truth, according to the polygraph machine, but that basically he had convinced himself that he was telling the truth. So that's how it came out. He strongly believed it, so it came out that way," end quote. According to what the FBI told Dorothy Yates, the data that registered on the polygraph machine, as then read in the normal way by the polygraph examiner, showed that Ralph Yates was telling the truth. His test was officially recorded as inconclusive, meaning the examiner wasn't sure if Yates was telling the truth, only because J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI had decided what the truth had to be for Yates. The FBI defined truth was that Yates had not picked up the Oswald Locke hitchhiker with the curtain rods package, because for the FBI, there could be no such hitchhiker. Therefore, Ralph Leon Yates, by being so definitive as shown in his polygraph chart, and knowing that he did precisely that, picked up a non-existent hitchhiker. What for any polygraph person would serve as proof of truth-telling was, in the case of Yates, proof only of an illusionary divorce from reality. The wrenching but undeniable truth for Yates, that he had helped a man that he thought was the president's assassin deliver what could have been his weapon to the book depository, was what compelled him to contact the FBI in the first place. Now he was being told his experience was nothing but an illusion. The FBI said so. Because of Yates' unswerving polygraph conviction to the contrary, he knew what had really happened. J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI knew what they had to do. They told him to report at once to a psychiatric hospital. Exactly what happened to Ralph Yates in the following days as a patient at Woodlawn Hospital, Dorothy Yates did not witness and does not know. She does know that one early morning, about a week later, Ralph broke out of Woodlawn. At 4 a.m., she opened the front door of their house to find Ralph standing barefoot on the steps in his white hospital clothes. Snow was swirling around him. Ralph told Dorothy he had escaped from the mental institution. He said he had tied sheets together and climbed down from a window. He then stole a car and drove home. Ralph was tormented by fear in a way Dorothy would see repeated for years. He told his wife someone was trying to kill them and their children because of what he knew about Oswald. She quickly bundled up their five sleepy children, the oldest of whom was six, and Ralph drove his family away from their house in the stolen car. Within a few hours, Dorothy was more alarmed by her husband's frantic efforts to evade their murder at every turn than she was by any unidentified killers. She returned the car and reported his whereabouts to Woodlawn Hospital authorities. Ralph was picked up and returned to Woodlawn. He was soon transferred to Terrell State Hospital, a psychiatric facility about 30 miles east of Dallas, where he lived for 8 years. He was then transferred to the Veterans Hospital in Waco, and finally to Rus State Hospital for the final year and a half of his life. While a patient at all three hospitals, he spent short periods from 1 to 3 months at home with his wife and children. In the course of Ralph's psychiatric treatment, Dorothy said he was given tranquilizing drugs to the point where they had made him walk around like a zombie. He learned to resist the process, she said. Just as Abraham Bolden had done in the Springfield Penitentiary psychiatric unit, Ralph faked swallowing the pills. More difficult to avoid were the shock treatments. He received over 40 of them. The impact of the shock treatments on his long-range memory was, his wife said, quote, "eventually nothing, because he didn't forget what he was there for, his encounter with the hitchhiker he had dropped off at Elm in Houston." Ralph told Dorothy, quote, "I don't know if they're trying to make me forget what happened or not, because I'm always going to say those things happened, because they did," end quote. To the end of his life, Ralph held on to the truth of his experience with the hitchhiker carrying the curtain rods. He never backed down, Dorothy said. Ralph died at Rust State Hospital on September 3, 1975, from congestive heart failure. He was 39 years old. Decades later, when I spoke to her in her home, Dorothy continued to ponder her husband's stubborn adherence to a strange story that in effect made him a prisoner in mental hospitals, took him away from a family he loved, and impoverished all of them. He was haunted by an experience he could not forget, for which he suffered for the rest of his life, because of his unwillingness to recant it. Dorothy would say that Ralph became a man obsessed. He wouldn't let it go. He believed it to be true, she said. This consumed Ralph. His thinking didn't go beyond that afterwards, she said. This just totally destroyed his life. She would go on to say, Ralph blamed himself for Kennedy's assassination. He said, I was the reason the president got killed. Dorothy would go on to say, if Ralph would have just shut up, his life wouldn't have been so bad. Everybody thought he was crazy, so he became crazy. Only the FBI knew why Ralph Yates needed to be taken seriously. Not even Yates himself, who had no sense of an Oswald double, understood the significance of what he felt compelled to say for the rest of his life. Only the Federal Bureau of Investigations recognized the importance of his testimony, with the threat it posed to the government's case against Lee Harvey Oswald. If evidence surfaced of the Oswald-like hitchhiker, who delivered his curtain rods to the depository 2 days before the assassination, it would have preempted and brought into question the government's endorsed curtain rod story, as given by Buell Wesley Frazier. Thanks to the bungling redundancy of cover stories, the plot to kill the president was again in danger of exposure. There were too many Oswalds in view, with too many smuggled rifles, retelling a familiar story to too many witnesses. At least one curtain rod story and the disposal witness who heard it had to go. The obvious person to be sacrificed was the hapless Ralph Leon Yates. His stubborn insistence on what he knew he had seen and heard from the man he had given a ride to had to be squelched. Ralph Yates then went through 11 years of hell. He could not forget and would not stop speaking about what he had witnessed when he picked up a man he thought was Lee Harvey Oswald, without ever understanding the full meaning of the experience, he refused to renounce it. Ralph Leon Yates was a family man, with a wife and 5 kids, who had never been in trouble with the law. But he died in a mental institution, where he was sent against his will, for the crime of passing lie detector test ordered by J. Edgar Hoover. Because the feds argued, he must be insane to believe a thing that they didn't think was true. Did all this happen to silence a man whose account might make people believe an Oswald lookalike was sent to Dallas to kill JFK and frame Oswald for it? No one can prove that, but it makes sense. And put this all together, and you've got all the essential ingredients that make a crazy theory a legitimate conspiracy. Every time I tell the story of Ralph Leon Yates, I get even more infuriated. The federal government ruined this man's life and the life of his family. What the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover did to this family is inexcusable. Just because Ralph's story didn't go along with the narrative that had been created for Lee Harvey Oswald. The day I sat in Dorothy's home and spoke with her, it was all I could do not to get emotional. You could still see the pain in her eyes because of what happened to her husband and ultimately their family. Now you understand why I said it was one of the saddest things to come from the JFK assassination. May Ralph Leon Yates rest in peace, for he sure wasn't given that in life after November 22, 1963. I know we have spent a couple episodes on this second Oswald theory, but I feel like it's important to the case. You can't explain away some of these sightings. Something was going on here. There was without a doubt a narrative being set up for Lee Harvey Oswald. So far, we've looked at the second Oswald sightings for weeks and months before the assassination, and today we look at the sightings the week of the assassination. Next week, we look at sightings of the second Oswald the day of the assassination, which include at the Texas School Book Depository building, possibly the Tippit shooting, inside the Texas Theater, in an El Chico's parking lot, and maybe on a getaway plane out of Dallas. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the 61st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the softcover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.